This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with education. Governor Maura Healey is proposing big spending on pretty much all facets of education in her first budget, and it comes at an important time. So across the Commonwealth, our education systems were dramatically transformed by COVID-19, by the pandemic. Early childhood care centers closed. Students and teachers in K through 12 spent at least a year learning and teaching online. Colleges saw enrollment dips. All of these institutions remain in flux. And the new Secretary of Education, Patrick Tutwiler, has oversight on all of it. He's here in Studio 2 to discuss his work, his priorities, and his hopes for the future of education in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Secretary, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so I want to have a little fun first, because in studying about you, I discovered that you have a real passion for barbecuing. Is this true?
This is accurate.
Okay, so I have to know the measure of hardcore. Have you cooked outside yet in 2023?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
What did you make? A brisket.
Oh, nice.
Yep, and it was good.
Awesome. And I understand one day you'd like to make a cookbook.
If someone will read it. If not, it will just be passed down to my children, and they will use it and hopefully get as good as I am now.
All right.
Some point.
So we have not cracked out the grill yet in 2023, and now I feel like we must not be serious.
Okay. That's all right.
All right. So listen, let's turn to the situation at hand. Sure. And I just want to start a little bit with your background. In education for more than 20 years, previously superintendent of the schools in Lynn, also in administrative positions in the Boston Public School. You were a history teacher at Brighton High School. In all of that, what do you find that now that you're in this Secretary of Education role, where's the place you go to in your head the most for resources, experience? What do you draw back on?
I actually go all the way back to the very beginning as a history teacher at Brighton High School. I think many leaders would agree with me that the magic is really in the classroom space. And so I can never forget that experience, and I bring it to bear on all of my thinking and decision-making. Brought it to my thinking when I was a principal, superintendent, and I absolutely will bring it to bear on my thinking as a superintendent, as a secretary as well.
So, you know, in taking the job, this is a big job. Mm-hmm. You were working at the Barr Foundation when you took the appointment. You have adolescent kids. There's a lot going on for education. What was it that made you say, I will walk away from where I am and I want to go take this on because I think I can do X?
Right. I think I can be part of the solution, right? As you mentioned in the outset, I've got 22 years of experience in the K-12 space and a diversity of spaces, frankly, in the K-12 experience. I've been in Wayland, I've been in Boston, I've been in Westford, and I've been in Lynn, and I've experienced a lot, I've seen a lot, and I've learned a lot. And I thought this was a unique opportunity to bring that learning, that experience to bear on some unique challenges in the current context.
So this question might sound obstreperous. I don't mean it to. I'm genuinely curious. Mm-hmm. Anytime somebody steps into a position like this, there's at least some sense, I could do it better than anyone else right now. So what is it that you think you can do to make a difference that comes from who you are, what you've done, how you've experienced the world?
I think I can frame the concerns in a way that maybe no one else can. I think I can use my experience, that credibility, to bring people together around the path forward in education in this state.
We're talking to the new Secretary of Education, Patrick Tutwiler, here in Studio 2. So I want to dive in now, this framing thing. That's the perfect segue, because in some of your first public remarks after you became secretary, you laid out a vision that was three concepts: stabilize, heal, and transform, which seems to me to say we are hurting and we need to change. Am I understanding those three words right from you?
You are. The stabilize and heal principles in that framing have to do with the fact that we are still in recovery. We are not out of the woods, so to speak. When we look at issues around mental health, around where students are in terms of skills and content knowledge, when we look at where we are in terms of openings, vacancies in the teaching space, we know that we still have a lot of work to do, and we needed organizing principles to frame our path forward, and those are the right ones.
So you just listed mental health and staffing, and in a minute, what I want to do, by the way, is go through, let's talk about early childhood education, let's talk K through 12, let's talk, higher ed. Are those the pain points? Mental health, staffing?
Those are the big ones, absolutely.
And there aren't any others. Those are the big two.
I don't think it's fair to say there aren't any others, but those are two significant things that really need our immediate attention in order to build to get to a place of addressing some of the other issues.
All right, so let's look at early childhood education. And I guess I'm assuming, all right, so you told lawmakers last week that the state needs to invest in some COVID-era programs or hundreds of providers could close. We're talking about the governor has a $1.5 billion roughly allocation for the Department of Early Education and Care. That's essentially to offset federal COVID funding. I'm assuming that in early ed, the pain point is staffing. Is that right?
It's staffing. It's sort of keeping their doors open, right? And to be clear, of that $1.5 billion, $475 million is allocated for what's become known as the Commonwealth Cares for Children or C3 grant, which providers use to sort of keep the lights on, pay operational costs, increase pay for staff, all of the things that would normally be deferred to families, the state is taking a bigger responsibility for.
So I want to ask about that specifically. Is it then the case that either A, we are simply at a point where the business model for early education and care doesn't work anymore and the government's going to have to pay for some of this period? Or B, we are not yet recovered from the pandemic and there is a runway, right? Or a landing strip that needs to be provided. Which is it?
I think it's A.
That's a big deal.
It is a big deal. You know, this is one of the sort of learnings from COVID is the state needs to take play a bigger role in supporting early education in the state. As we look nationally, Massachusetts ranks 43rd in terms of the level of funding for early education. And
you mean the level that the state puts into early
correct,
education?
Correct. Okay. Correct. And that's not a place where we want to be. It's not about the rankings, but it is about how can we create a model that's sustainable, that allows for child care to be affordable in the state and for our providers to have everything they need to provide high quality services for kids.
So what the governor is proposing is roughly 25% more in state funding. Do you think that's sustainable? If the matter is states got to now pay for things that the state didn't used to pay for, mm-hmm. You're looking at $1.5 billion. That's about 25% more than before. That's just the shape of things to come?
I believe so. And keep in mind that there are new funding streams, revenue streams that will support that sort of shift going forward. And I'm talking about the Fair Share funding stream. In this particular budget, $100 million of the C3 grants is funded through Fair Share. There are other buckets, for lack of better expression, that the administration drew from to get us to that place. But I do think that, yes, it reflects a mindset shift. And there's a way to fund it going forward.
So just for listeners, Fair Share is the new ballot measure that was passed last year that that places a surcharge of additional taxes on people who earn more than $1 million. And those are earmarked for transportation and education.
Correct.
All right. So as we transition into K-12, Secretary Tutwiler, I am thinking about a simple question that one of our producers asked this morning. Listen, if we just paid teachers more in early education and care and in K-12, would most of these problems go away? Is this really just that we don't pay people enough?
I think that is not the be-all, end-all. Certainly, I would say as a former teacher, a principal superintendent, you know, we want to make sure that teachers are compensated, you know, have the resources that they need, have the supports that they need. I'm really committed to that. But at the same time, we know that there are other things that make teachers stay in place, that help them thrive in their work. It is not just as simple as raising pay and then all other issues fall by the wayside.
So name two things other than pay that keep people in place and help them thrive as educators.
I think their ability to feel success in their classrooms or you know, whatever role they're playing in a school is huge. And actually, this is a research-supported element that to the extent that teachers feel or educators feel that they are making a difference and can be successful because they have the supports and the resources to do their jobs well, that's huge, right, in terms of longevity and stay power. And then also having opportunities to learn and grow, right? Are there robust professional development opportunities, ways for people to continue to move forward in the profession? That's another big piece. It's not just pay alone.
Who's that teacher from K through 12 in your life that you still think about, that still, you know, sort of you carry in your heart?
Well, I'll start with the first teacher I had, which is my mother, who is also an educator, who I think reflected in her, in the way that she raised my brother and me, the kinds of things that you see in many classrooms, and I'm sure were present in her classrooms. Extraordinary care, right? Willing to go to the end of the earth for us. A willingness to keep learning and growing. My mother earned a doctorate at the University of Texas, a single parent, doing it all by herself, but felt like this was something she could achieve. And so set the standard high for my brother and me. No excuses. You can do this kind of thing. So first her, but then I would say also my kindergarten teacher, Miss Session at Booker T. Washington Elementary School in Champaign, Illinois. I have a fond recollection of my experience there. She was no nonsense. It was a warm and loving experience, but she really drew the best out of us. And I can't do it was never a statement that she would accept in her classroom. So my mind goes back to her as well.
So I want to talk about K through 12 now, and there are two things sort of heavily on my mind. One is learning loss. You know, the Educational Opportunity Project at Stanford says that on average during the pandemic, Massachusetts students lost 75% of a school year's worth of math, 41% of a school year's worth of reading. The other is mental health, where the CDC just came out in February with a report that said that 42% of high school students reported that they had persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Those two things together feel staggering. Mm-hmm. How on earth do you take all of that on in our public schools?
Mm-hmm. I think one step at a time, right? Prioritizing, in my view, first mental health, which schools across our state are doing really innovative and substantive things in that space. One such example is the implementation of the universal mental health screen. That means screening all of our students to get a sense of where they are, if they're experiencing mental health challenges, and then leveraging a multi-tiered system to meet their needs, whether it's doing something simple at the tier one space or something more concentrated and involved at a higher tier. That feels to me like an important thing for us to focus on. And in the governor's budget, there's an increase of $1 million to support districts in moving in this direction.
I'm going to stop you there.
Please.
Because that's important, but also $1 million isn't very much.
Mm-hmm. $1 million additional, right? So it's $2 million. And that's not to say this isn't supporting districts who are ready for that move. There are a whole host of other mental health strategies and supports that districts are leveraging. That's just one example of a robust way to move forward that the governor's first budget it shows an increase in.
And how about learning loss?
Learning loss is it's a challenge, right? And we know that, to your point, there are significant concerns with numeracy in the mathematics space and with literacy. I believe deeply in what the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education has pushed forward as a path forward to addressing learning loss. It's through the acceleration agenda, which means helping teachers create a scenario in their classroom where they are teaching grade level material, but providing the appropriate scaffolds to allow students to reach that grade level material, except not going the direction of remediation, which is if you're in fourth grade teaching third grade material with hopes that the student will catch up. Exactly. That has been their approach. That's something that worked in New Orleans, after, devastation hit there, the acceleration approach showed real promise. And that's what's happening in our state right now and being pushed. We think that's going to show big returns.
We're talking with Secretary of Education Patrick Tutwiler. Before we let you go, I do want to talk for just a minute about higher ed. And I think the place to start is the governor would like to, wants to set aside $20 million from the state's 2024 budget to make community college free for residents older than 25. We know the legislature has expressed interest in maybe it's free for everybody. Mm-hmm. Can we really get to it being free for some X number of people? Can we really do that and sustain that?
I think so. What we've proposed in the first year, the $20 million for residents age 25 and above, we're expecting that 1,000 to 3,000 current community college students would be eligible for this benefit. An additional 5,000 to 6,000 we're predicting will take advantage of it. So approaching 10,000 in the first year. We're really excited about this. And as we visit community colleges across the state, we're hearing equal excitement both by staff and by prospective students as well. I think this is a place to start, right? And really sort of refine how we leverage this type of program before we move to the free community college for all.
Last question. Are you invited to like 700 graduations this year as Secretary of Education?
A lot of them. I'm a big person, but I can only be in one place at one time. but really enjoying getting out and connecting with students and with leaders and hearing their stories. And so I'll do as many as I can.
Will you come back and talk to us again?
Of course.
There's so much more to cover.
You invite me, I'll come.
Patrick Tutwiler is the new Secretary of Education. Secretary, thanks for taking some time out of your day.
Pleasure's mine.
Listening to that conversation, joining us now, Carrie Young, WBUR senior education reporter. She's been covering Tutwiler, the new administration's education priorities, and really all things education, joins us from Studio 2B. Carrie, let's just start with your reactions to what you heard.
Boy, we covered a lot of ground. I'm definitely impressed with just how much the secretary did have to say. I have to say one thing that stuck out to me in the conversation and that I've noticed in previous news stories that I've covered about him is just how much previous experience he has in schools, in the classroom.
And is that substantially different than we might have seen in the past?
It really was. I mean, the Secretary Tutwiler has 20 years experience in a school in the education realm. And previous administrations didn't have nearly that much. The exact number is not on off the top of my head, but you can really tell that you can really hear that experience come through. I mean, when you watch things like the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education meetings, it's like the State Board of Education. They make some larger policy decisions, and when they were making a decision recently about accountability and how long districts would have to catch up in academics, Secretary Tutwiler relied on experience he had while leading the schools in Lynn, saying, this is what I saw, this is what you guys really need to consider. And quite a few people on that board also don't have near the depth of experience he had in a classroom. So it made a big difference. And that was something that really, yeah, that popped into my head thinking, this is not something I've heard before.
Carrie, it struck me too, and I guess I'm checking this against your experience, right, that he was more open about the need to heal and stabilize, about the pain, the loss that students have experienced since the start of the pandemic than I am used to hearing from a public official. Is that just me, or did you notice that as well?
No, I've definitely noticed that as well, especially, I mean, I'm going to go back to the discussions around the accountability plan that the state was trying to come up with. It surprised me, quite frankly, to hear the State Department of Education and to hear the secretary talk about, like, listen, there are realities of what happened during the pandemic, the traumas that kids went through and the mental health struggles that they're still having, and that we need to keep those in account and have realistic goals here. And that definitely seems like a change. And to hear an administration talk that openly about it is very surprising.
We're debriefing our conversation with the new Secretary of Education here in Massachusetts with senior education reporter Carrie Young. I talked with Patrick Tutwiler about early ed. He was quite transparent that he believes the future of early education and care is going to require a kind of consistent state spending that we haven't done, that the business model doesn't work if the state doesn't spend money. Just react to that.
Yeah, I think I was surprised by that, too. I mean, I think that is a big statement to make, right, to say that, this is kind of a policy shift in terms of just how much the state is open to putting towards a service like this. There are different sides on just how much the state should be putting towards it. But, I mean, looking at Governor Healey's proposed budget, the 25%, I think, increase in early education and care is huge.
That's a big number.
It's huge, especially compared to, I mean, this was pre-pandemic and pre, millionaire's tax. But there were times when the increase to the early education and care sector didn't even hit inflation. And so to see 25% is just like, that's like whiplash when I'm thinking back to that.
And Carrie, we talked about the governor's budget proposals, and several times Secretary Tutwiler drew on the new money that comes from the millionaire's tax, right? The over $1 million goes to education. The taxes on that go to education and transportation. Does the governor get to say that, or does the legislature have a say? Can she pick where the allocations come from, or is there a negotiation with the legislature on that, as there is on so much else when it comes to a state budget?
Well, with a state budget, everyone has to agree, is my understanding. And so right now, we're just hearing what Governor Healey's budget proposal is. And so I would imagine, you know, we'll have similar discussions with the House and Senate. So I think we need to wait and see a little bit. But just hearing the governor's priorities, there's going to be more, you know, negotiations to know where she stands and where a lot of that energy is going to go. I mean, I think that's important.
Couple other things I wanted to touch on with you, Carrie. One, the emphasis on mental health in K through 12, especially adolescents, which we're increasingly becoming aware of as a pretty urgent problem. And I will say, if you or a loved one is experiencing a mental health crisis, the Mental Health Crisis Hotline is available by phone or text 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that number is 988. Are you seeing kind of a consensus across people in the field of education that we've hit some kind of, I don't know if wall is the right word, Carrie, but you know what I mean, some kind of wall on adolescent mental health?
Right, that something needs to change kind of thing. I mean, I think the previous administration definitely did put a significant focus on mental health. It became very apparent during the pandemic that students were going to come back to school with a lot of trauma and needs to sort things out, especially to get back to, I don't know if baseline's the right word, but really to help them through the day and succeed in school, right? Pre-pandemic, I remember there were a handful of districts. I remember in Methuen, they were doing that universal mental health screening at throughout the district. That the secretary referred to. And so to me, it was just like, it was interesting to see that this might be something that all districts could be doing soon, rather than that just sort of handful, that coalition that was doing that before the pandemic.
So what are you watching for now, Carrie?
Well, I mean, I think I'm watching to see where a lot of this money ends up going once the budget becomes official. You know, I think I'm curious to see in years to come, maybe, where funding will go. You know, like if Governor Healey's plans did come through, what did that result in, right? Like, did results improve academically and also when it comes to students' mental health? So, yeah, I'll be looking long term, I think, right now.
Watching the results.
Oh, yeah.
WBUR senior education reporter Carrie Young, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Have you been to a concert lately? Have you seen live music? 3 years after COVID shut down the live music scene worldwide, the industry is back, but it's changed, and in more ways than one. As we look to the next few years, what can we expect, especially from an artistic community that has weathered so much? So what stays, what goes, what changes? Well, we have three guests who know the industry inside and out. They're going to explore that with us. First, WBUR arts and culture reporter Amelia Mason here in Studio 2, and Boston-based artist and musician Oompa also here in Studio 2. Amelia, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you.
And J.J. Gonson, owner of Once, a former brick-and-mortar venue in Somerville, now a music booking and hosting organization in Greater Boston. J.J.'s on the line. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much.
All right. So to start, Oompa, I'm going to play a little sound for you. See if you recognize this.
Okay. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? That's their mama.
So that's you. Let's hear a little more. You're performing at Great Scott, April 2018.
Wow.
The sound is courtesy of the record company. And I want to know, I think that was your first...
sold-out show.
There you go.
It was my first independent headlining show.
And Great Scott, of course, now closed.
Rest
so
in peace, Great Scott. Yeah.
What does it make you think to hear that?
That, it made me... I was really happy hearing that because I just remember the energy of that time, I remember just being so hungry and like wanting so badly to have to build this career, and then looking out and seeing 200 plus people there for me in a sold out show was so affirming for me to just think that I could have a career that starts here, you know, in this real way. So that and Dear Mama was just such an important song at that time for me.
Why?
So it was my first project was called November 3rd, which was a dedication to my mom who passed. And it was about that time period. It was just me processing all the things that had happened, all the intersectional identities that I held and how that impacted like grief and losing my mom. And Dear Mama was like the song. The heart of it was a letter to her and my commitment to making a life outside of death.
So Amelia Mason, I mean, the weight of that music, the experience, can we meet artists in the same way when we can't meet them in a 200-room space live?
What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, so getting to know new artists, falling in love with or connecting to their music in a really deep way feels like the intimacy of a small live space
is
an important part.
Yes, I would agree. And it's very hard to get that in other ways. I mean, people do it on the internet, and that's great. But yeah, I do indeed have a soft spot for those small, intimate venues. Where the scene is, where it's happening, you know.
So as we thought about how to have this conversation today, Amelia, one of the things that we thought about was, okay, let's talk about what we've lost, right? What we gained and what comes next. Mm-hmm. And in this what we've lost space, the more I was reading and getting ready for this, the more I got the sense that what we've lost are those smaller venues, are those intimate spaces where we can really get to know our local artists like Oompa for the first time in person. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair. I mean, I don't have, like, data on it. I was looking it up right before this. You know, there's been surveying showing, like, huge impacts to the cultural sector in Massachusetts generally. But I would agree when it comes to live music, those smaller venues have always been the ones that struggled, and they already were, actually, because you were seeing changes in audience behavior before this. You know, anyone can sit at home and stream Netflix and... And, you know, rents going up mean that small businesses that are private businesses that are restaurants and bars and music venues were already struggling to stay in the city. And then you had the pandemic add to that. And I think it really just it just made those pressures so much worse.
JJ Gonson, how much of that is once?
That's all once. I'm just sitting here nodding. Yeah, the. Our venue, we had two rooms. One was 100 and the other was 400. And there's not a lot of places around Boston in either of those sizes now. We have this proliferation of very large venues, Roadrunner, Big Night Live, places like that, which are bringing in very large bands, but very few smaller rooms. And we did lose a lot of smaller rooms in addition to once the Milky Way and Great Scott and Bull McCabe's. And there was just a huge, huge number of them. I can't remember, and I'm sorry that I don't know these numbers either. I work with the National Independent Venue Association, and we probably do have some numbers, but I remember that at the beginning of the pandemic, we lost seven. So some have reopened, Wally's, the classic jazz venue, but once couldn't survive. There was no way. We were barely holding on as it was. I totally agree with what Amelia is saying, that rents have gone up. The pressure of development has made it harder and harder to find rooms. So I've been looking now for 3 years for a replacement room, and it's very hard to find anything that's even close to manageable as a for-profit business. There's not a lot of support for for-profit businesses. And really, we all kind of need to become nonprofit art organizations.
Oh, man.
I think that's at least part of the solution.
So, Oompa, you're just nodding there.
Yeah.
So pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. Yeah, it's just unfortunate. I think that just seeing that loss of small venues, I think that those spaces, again, were just places where folks could build community, catapult their careers, grow, get feedback, make money. Yeah. And I feel deeply for the loss of once, you know, in these smaller venues.
So at the end of this month, Atwoods in Cambridge is also closing. We've got a little sound here. This is Duke Levine with Club Duke playing Berber Song at Atwoods Tavern in October of 2016. Okay, A, I just love it.
Yeah, that's good.
But, I was just there.
Who was there, JJ?
You were just there, JJ.
I was just there a couple nights ago, yeah.
Did you talk with the owners?
Was everyone crying?
I didn't talk with the owners, but I talked with a lot of people, and it's the same story that you're already telling. You know, there's no real way to make it work. Mm. The rents are too high. The costs are too high. It's just, it's very difficult at that level to make it work. You know, the big places, what are they doing? They're taking 75% on tickets in fees to fund their big companies. And the smaller venues obviously don't do that. But even if we did, like, what are we going to do? Take 75% on a $10 ticket? That's not going to keep us alive.
So we're speaking with J.J. Gonson, who's the owner of the music booking group Once Oompa, a Boston-based musician and artist, and Amelia Mason, who's WBUR arts and culture reporter. We're looking at the state of live music right now, focused on what we've lost. Amelia, we reached out to our texting group. We got so many questions and thoughts. And if you want to join our texting group, you start by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. I'll give you that number one more time, 617-766-0382. So Taihi of Boston said, funny, I went to see little brother downstairs at the Middle East last night on Thursday, because this was a text from the end of the week last week. First show since pre-COVID, I was definitely leery about it all. Maybe two masks, and I wasn't one of them. Little brother rocked it, though. And that is the other piece, right? I don't want to talk about the pandemic like it's over.
Yeah.
And the challenges of people still... people are singing, they're tight spaces, right? A lot of drinking. I've been to some live music, and it is, I was at Wally's not that long ago, Oompa, right? And that's a tight intimate space.
They're the best.
How do we adjust to that piece?
I don't know. I can't tell exactly how much the COVID hesitancy is affecting everything versus the just sort of everybody's kind of habits have changed. Not to diminish that concern. I think that's a real concern for a subset of people, definitely. But I've also been to some of those bigger venues and that JJ referenced. Audiences are back there. You know, they're drinking. They're not wearing masks. They're going for better. You know, whatever you may think of that, they are going out. I think the small venues are different. They like operate in a different way. They attract a different kind of audience. Maybe some of those people are more hesitant. But also, I think it reflects a different instinct. It's the instinct to go down to your local bar and check out what's happening, and that's a different kind of casual thing.
So Alexander of Brighton texted in. It's a longer comment, but I'm just going to pull the first part. I'm out 2 to 4 nights a week checking out local bands at small venues, mostly in Cambridge and Boston. So that is a piece of the comeback, Oompa. Mm. But there's also this other way now, and I want to talk a little bit about Zoom. I'm going to play a little bit of a sound here. This is the artist FC. They're performing in October 2020 over Zoom for Northeastern student magazine Tastemakers. Their song is called Field Recordings.
Can't tell you what it is that makes me drawn to you. Can't find the courage to talk.
So, Oompa, what's missing is the crowd response that we heard, right, from you. I also feel like I get a sense for the artist. So, what do we gain with Zoom performances? Is it enough? How do you think about them as an artist?
Yeah, so I love live performance. It's like, it is the heart of the thing for me. And I always say that performance is a two-way street. You have an audience. They deserve to be a part of that performance. You know, they give you something that makes you come alive. And in turn, you give them something that hopefully makes them feel the same way. And, you know, we did a lot of stuff virtually in the pandemic. And it was great to be able to say we're still here. We're still doing music. We get to do the thing that we love as best we can. But that interaction, you're reading comments, hoping to understand what someone is feeling. And also, it was just really strange for me, at least personally, to be performing to my camera. You know, I love that part of this for me. The biggest part of this for me is connection. And I think that that was something that I lost. But I think it speaks to the spirit of artists who really want to be here and really want to do this, that that was the pivot that we made when we had to. I miss it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm seeing people perform online. They just do it. It's more like TikTok clips or like, there's an appetite to consume it, but I don't know if it's in Zoom rooms.
Yes.
In fact, I think it's not.
You think that, go ahead, JJ.
Oh, we actually, once actually stands for one night creative event. And a big part of that concept is that you're there and you're having that experience. And we did pivot to virtual and it was not the same. It was really important, like, to be together at all in any way. But the second we could go back to being in a safe way, we did 26, we basically opened an outdoor venue in the summer and of 21. And that was all about getting back to that one time experience.
So I want to play a little bit of that sound. So once, as you said, JJ has embraced the outdoor concert experience. So this is the band Happy Little Clowns. It's Clouds, excuse me. August 2021, Boynton Yards in Somerville. It's a once Somerville production, and the song is called Fool. So everything about that feels different than the Zoom that we heard before. Outdoors can be a wonderful option. Is it, you know, are there new ways to be creative about outdoor performance as we transition back from a global pandemic? JJ.
Yeah, outdoor is super complicated because it's very hard to build an outdoor scenario. It might rain or it might be very windy and you have to actually create it. So it's not economically, it's not feasible either because it takes so much work to build something outside every single time. So it actually is not, I think it would be a real solution if you could have an installation that stayed put, but it's not like a venue where you can close it and lock it at night. And then when you open it in the morning, the equipment is there and ready to go.
Yeah. And Oompa, you keyed in on the economic piece of that.
Yeah. So my manager comes from the production talent buying space. And so I'm often, you know, and I'm always here with big ideas. I want to do a festival outside. And he's like, yes, and, you know, it's not necessarily economically feasible in the same way because, like JJ said, you're having to build this space and you're having to come back to it, and there's just a lot of money that's required to keep that maintained, and it's not feasible even for artists who are trying to build that or trying to be a part of that.
Continuing our discussion here on what's next for the future of live music with a panel that knows a lot about the subject, WBUR arts and culture reporter Amelia Mason, Boston-based artist and musician Oompa, and JJ Gonson, owner of Once, a former brick-and-mortar venue in Somerville, now a music booking and hosting organization. I'm going to pick back up with another comment from our texting group, Amelia Mason. Gwen of Cambridge said, I would love more outdoor concerts as someone who is still reluctant to go into a crowded space where unmasked folks drink a lot. The new state office for outdoor recreation could collaborate with local musicians to give communities across Massachusetts the opportunity to enjoy some of our amazing talent outside in fresh air under the sky. Now, the emphasis there was the outdoor, which we were talking about before the break. But the partnerships is also an interesting dimension.
Yeah.
And what are you hearing, seeing around responsiveness from local elected officials, the state, other nonprofit organizations recognizing this need to maintain a live music culture?
There's definitely a lot of interest in trying to make sure that it doesn't all disappear and go away. I mean, a lot of the conversations have revolved around space generally for artists to do work, whether that's music or other things. There's definitely interest in the city of Boston specifically in trying to figure out ways to better support spaces that might be in danger of displacement, helping them maybe buy their property or replace it somehow, leveraging development to get, you know, maybe, I mean, I think in an ideal world, they would love to have developers chipping into a citywide fund. I mean, that's not a thing yet, but that kind of stuff is definitely on the table. I think when it comes to artists staying here, there's a whole lot of other interventions that would help that, especially around housing.
Oompa, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the ability of artists to stay here and thrive in the music business,
Ooh-y.
Given where we are and where we might be going.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we didn't need a hit as a city in terms of like the pandemic. But I think that people largely feel like they have to leave the city in order to find some real success and to be able to like find a financially viable pathway into a long standing career. And it just kind of feels sometimes like a desperate situation. And one of the things that I've been doing to respond to that is starting a collective, which is going to serve as a cultural agency to kind of just build a bunch of like, we're going to collectivize our talents and make great art, but also it's a decision-making body, some force that can start to come in and have these conversations with larger entities about what it is that artists really want and what it is that artists need to be able to sustain.
And when you say a larger entity, what do you mean? Do you mean like the new MGM performance venue at Fenway? Is that what you mean by a larger entity?
I mean anybody anybody who's looking to make decisions on behalf of the culture, anybody who's looking to book music artists or just really think about what it means to create an economic vehicle for artists to stay here. And that's the city, that's government officials, that is private corporations, that is the larger venues, you know, and just people who are looking to commission art who really want to talk to the culture and the space. I think it's important that artists not get tokenized or for it to be in a vacuum or speak on behalf of an entire community, but to collectivize a bunch of different voices come from different places and be able to say, this is what's important to us and we can get it done.
So J.J. Gonson of Once, I want to stay in that general space. I'm going to go back to another part of a text sent in by Alexander of Brighton. The concern is that while we have great new mid-size venues opening such as Roadrunner and MGM, it's the smaller feeder venues that are losing ground and closing, not to mention practice space for artists to hone their chops, disappearing at an alarming rate. We are losing a part of the culture that makes the Boston area what it is. So as one who has pivoted to find a way to stay in this space, keep our culture whole, there is concern that there was a Boston music scene that may not be one that kids growing up now find in their 20s and 30s. Do we have the ability to hold it together, JJ? And what's key for that?
I really hope so. I think that person really hit the nail right on the head. You know, you played Happy Little Clouds. They moved out of town. There's a lot of people moving away. There is no shortage of fantastic musicians and bands here. You don't know it in a lot of cases because there's nowhere for them to go to play. I agree with what Oompa's saying, but I want to add to that. I agree that the larger entities are going to be critical to the survival of smaller spaces. And I don't mean that the larger entities should be opening those smaller spaces, because I don't think that's the solution. But I do think that we're going to need to see some kind of financial and space support. And the problem is, and I was listening to what Oompa was saying, and I think that those grassroots organizations are critical because most of us don't know where to begin when it comes to approaching a sponsor or approaching a government official to ask for help or even to write for a grant. If there is a grant available, I really struggle with this stuff. I'm a creative person, and just understanding how to discourse with business people for me is very difficult. So I think we need representation that speaks to us and makes these opportunities available without having to write 60 pages of grant proposal.
Amelia.
Yeah. I mean, what JJ is saying really resonates. And I think also something she said earlier, too, about how a lot of these smaller venues are for profit. They're small businesses. And, you know, in all the reporting I've done when it comes to sort of arts advocacy and the government getting involved, that's a big hole of where I haven't heard a lot of or any maybe sort of creative solutions proposed to help them. Because these are like restaurants and bars and music venues, and they have to pay rent usually to private owners too, and they are not able to leverage some of the things that are out there to help arts organizations, which are usually nonprofits.
So I want to come back to small, right? Small venues, small shows. But now I want to talk small. All right. So here's an artist, Pink Navel, performing their song Bottle.dav, January 2018, as part of Alston Pudding's Kitchen Sessions.
Love Pink Navel.
Yeah. Sick and tired, so tired. Follow me on Twitter, maybe. Maybe get the beat from Carver. Yeah. I'm good. in and get the beat from Kenny. I am grateful my
position. So, Oompa, you reacted right away. We're talking small kitchen, basements, DIY spaces. How where does that fit in the ecosystem?
It has always been a part of it. You know, I think that whole cultures and genres have been born in basements. You know what I mean? And movements have been born in basements. And the one thing I know about artists, and particularly in my genre of hip hop and that R&B space, we're going to scrap. We know what it's like to have to scrap to be valued. So we're going to do that, you know, no matter where the four walls or not are, you know, whether that is a backyard or a basement, we're going to make it happen. It would just be nice to have something more systematized like the smaller venues. But one of the things that I'm hopeful about is to see what we become as a city, knowing that we have a lot to fight for and fight against. And I just wonder what music and what heart we're going to make and what identity we're going to have at the end of that. But I believe in us.
So, Amelia, listening to this makes me wonder, okay, well, is that something we could do better? The pipeline from the basement or the kitchen, is there an opportunity there that we could intentionally pick up? And it's interesting, just for listeners, JJ's nodding, Oompa's nodding, Amelia, you said yes, so pick that up, Amelia.
Well, I mean, I don't know a lot about what the best way to do that would be, but before this conversation, I was thinking about it. I mean, I've heard of really cool stuff happening in gallery spaces, and as we mentioned earlier, basements, which aren't always super safe, and you have this tension there with regulation, right, and safety and fire safety and stuff, which is real. But I would love to see ways that the city or the state could encourage and make it easier, maybe, to have ad hoc shows in spaces that are not traditionally being used. I mean, I would just love to see it be easier for people to put shows on in small spaces that maybe weren't built for it originally.
So JJ, pick up that thread.
Well, yeah. So we've been doing a series at La Brasa in East Boston, in East Somerville. Really simple. Stick PA. We push the tables back. It's free. Like, they give a little bit of a cut from the bar to the bands. And it's, you know, just trying to find anywhere to give an opportunity to bands. The basement shows are absolutely critical. I couldn't agree more with that. But even those are limited because there's not that many basements.
Who has a basement?
There's not that many houses, you know, like who has a garage? Like, even those situations are pretty hard to come by. And there's just only so many opportunities even there. And a lot of the times those are like friends of the people who live in the house. So it's not necessarily a really open opportunity because the bands who don't know those people might never even know how to talk to those people. So I think there is, I certainly look at who's playing those shows when I'm thinking about new bands and who might be somebody to book.
Yeah.
So in our last just 10 seconds, Oompa, you said you were hopeful. Mm-hmm. Just say a little more hope for us.
Yeah, I think that we deserve great space. I think we deserve big space. I think we deserve mobility. And I also just really believe in our collective power to be great no matter where we are and no matter what's presented to us. So I've got hope. I love the city. I love the artists in it.
So Oompa is a Dorchester rapper and artist.
Roxbury.
Roxbury, thank you. Sorry for the mistake there. WBUR Arts and Culture reporter Amelia Mason also with us. And JJ Gonson, owner of Once, which is formerly Brick and Mortar in Somerville, now a music booking and hosting organization. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Such important work.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Join us again tomorrow for more. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening.